This program is part of the Cosmic Potato Podcast Network. For more shows like this, visit our website at cosmicpotato.com.
In 1966, the world was introduced to a new frontier of science fiction known as Star Trek. Since then, it has grown into a franchise spanning multiple TV series and motion pictures. People from all walks of life have grown up with Star Trek. It has molded them, taught them life lessons, and helped to build them into who they are. These are the stories of those fans. This is their prime direction.
Hey everybody, and welcome to the Prime Direction, the Star Trek fandom podcast. My name is Sean Ray, and this month I got to talk to Brandon Ushio. Brandon is one of the hosts of the fandom podcast, which you can find on all the usual places that you find podcasts, like iTunes and Stitcher and Google Play and all of that. The fandom podcast puts out two shows every week. One of their shows is more news-based, where they talk about some entertainment news, what's going on in the world of Star Trek, Star Wars, Marvel, all of that. And then the other show is more of a discussion type show. And they also have a game-based show every month where they play trivia games and things like that. So if you like shows like this one and like Cosmic Potato, then you'll probably like the fandom podcast as well. So I urge you to go over to wherever you normally find podcasts and look that up. They also have a Facebook page, so go and check that out. But I got to talk to Brandon this month about his fandom, and I'm pleased to be able to share that discussion with you this month. So make sure you go over to iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast Addict on the Android Store, and subscribe to this show so you'll get a notification every time that there's a new episode. And make sure that you visit us on our website at cosmicpotato.com. You'll also find all of the other podcasts that are on the network, like Cosmic Potato, Captain Game Show, World War G, and Reviewomania. And make sure that while you're subscribing to the show, you subscribe to the network feed. If you look up on your podcatcher, just search for Cosmic Potato Podcast Network, then you'll find the feed that when you subscribe to it, you'll get a notification every time we put a new episode of any of the shows on there. So if I put up a new episode of Cosmic Potato, it'll be on there. New episode of World War G, it'll be on there. Review Mania, Captain Game Show, all that stuff. So subscribe to that and you'll keep up with the entire network. And that's gonna do it for everything that I have to say here at the beginning. So enjoy this episode and I will see you next time.
How long have you been doing the fandom podcast?
We've been doing the fandom podcast since, I think we've been doing it for about 3 years now, almost four. No, 4 years. It's been 4 years.
Yeah.
Time flies. Let's just say that.
So. You live in Utah, right?
Yep. I live in Utah and my co-hosts, we all live in Utah, but we all live in different cities. So it makes it fun for scheduling, not quite like time zones like we've had, but just to get remote participation.
Yeah. Have you lived in Utah your whole life?
I grew up in Salt Lake City, and then for 2 years I served an LDS mission in California, okay, which is a vast and exotic land, I guess. But no, aside from those 2 years, I have been in Utah somewhere, one city or another.
What was life like growing up?
Growing up, you know, life was... I don't know. I mean, it's life's how it is. I was thinking about this today because I grew up and as I was thinking about it, I was a little different than most people around here. But I mean, Utah gets a little bit of a rap about diversity because diverse here is tall blonde or short blonde.
Yeah.
And I am a 6'5" half Japanese man. Right. So I stuck out a little bit here. But growing up, I don't know, for the most part, I don't know, because it was, there was such a lack of diversity, I almost viewed myself as white. There wasn't a whole lot of, no one really saw color as far as I could tell when we were kids, at least, because there was really no color.
Right. Yeah. Did you have a lot of brothers and sisters, or?
So I am the second of four children.
Okay.
That feels like a Borg designation, second of four.
Right.
But, yeah, no. So I've got an older brother, a younger brother, and a younger sister, and we're all kind of nerdy. And I grew up in a house. We grew up. We were comfortable, but we were not well off. My dad always worked crazy hours to make sure to provide for us. But we had a fairly small house for us, and so my older brother and younger brother and I all shared a bedroom. It was actually a 3-car garage that had been converted into a recording studio.
Oh wow!
And then turned into a bedroom for the kids. And I think my parents designed it that way because then when we were fighting, they could just close the door and they wouldn't hear a thing.
So it was converted into a recording studio. So were your parents into radio or something?
The people who lived there before I did were musicians.
Oh, okay.
And so they took out the big bay door that a garage normally has, and they sealed it up, and they just, it was a recording studio.
Okay.
They put a breezeway between the house and the garage, so there was it was indoors the entire way out and in. But
were your siblings into sci-fi and stuff as much as you are?
Oh yeah, we are all nerds. We grew up watching all sorts of sci-fi together, from British sci-fi, Blake 7, Doctor Who, things like that, Red Dwarf, the comedy stuff.
Yeah.
To like Star Trek was. I was thinking about this and. My first experience with Star Trek was probably 1993 because we went on a family vacation. And I remember this because I looked up the date, but I remember the episode. The episode was The Gambit. I don't know if you...
Yeah.
It's the one... it's a two-parter. Right. And we went on vacation and we were going to be gone over the second half. And my first memory of Star Trek, like visceral memory, is we were up in a cabin in the mountains, and we were all gathered around a small little, like, it was probably like 13-inch TV, and I was holding the rabbit ears and my dad had one sibling sitting in one spot and I was holding the rabbit ears in a certain spot, and none of us could move because then that changed the reception because we had to see how it ended because it was before the days of the DVR and all of that.
Yeah. Okay. So your earliest memory of Star Trek is The Next Generation.
Yes.
So how old are you, by the way?
That's a good question. you stop counting after a little bit. But I'm 34 years old.
Okay. Yeah, that kind of gives me an idea. Because when I ask guests what their earliest memory of Star Trek is, usually I get... when I was a little child, I remember seeing Spock on TV or something like that. And it's almost always the original series. I very rarely hear anybody say their earliest memory is the Next Generation. So that's interesting. So after you saw that episode, did that just turn you on to the show? Or was that something that came later?
Well, so I watched lots of Star Trek before that. Like, that was one of the things that my dad. I mean, my dad is kind of a paradox because he's a football playing, sports loving. He works for Nike now, and he absolutely. I mean, he's all into sports. But I remembered Star Trek. If he was home and it was on, we were watching it.
Oh, okay.
And so we watched it before then. It was just one of those shows that was dad's show.
You just didn't really pay attention to it. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, and it was Star Trek. So there were spaceships and phasers. And I mean, that was cool to watch.
Mm-hmm.
But to give you a frame of reference, in 93, I was 9 years old.
Right.
And so before then, I didn't get it. I don't think I got it at all. But it was always on. And I knew that it was important to dad. And so I would watch it with him. So I remember watching that, and I remember, like, when I would stay home sick from school, that they would have the original series in syndication, and I'd watch that. But Star Trek was just always on. It was always a thing in our house. Then years went down the road, and DS9 comes out, And that was one that my older brother, dad was working a lot more at that time. So my older brother, that was his show. That was his Star Trek. And, mm-hmm. you know, cause when you got siblings, you had to fight for the TV time,
right?
Who gets to watch what, when, and compare schedules. And DS9 was his. And I started watching it with him, and I really liked it, but I knew I didn't have to sacrifice my TV time because, well, that was his thing that he was going to spend that on. So, but when I first decided, no, this one is mine, was with Voyager.
Okay.
because, and I know that's one of those shows where people either love it or they hate it. It's either great Star Trek or it's not. Like, I feel like Voyager is more it stirs up more contention in the Star Trek community than Enterprise does. Because, you know, Enterprise, most people will say it's terrible. Some people will say that, well, if you look past this, 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 and this, usually the studio meddling stuff, you can say, oh, that was actually pretty good. But, you know, there's not arguments, but like, people loved Voyager, they hated it.
Yeah.
And so there's always a lot of contention about that. But I just remember that being, you know, this one's mine. And yeah, I'm a sucker for being torn away from home and having to find your way back. And
yeah,
so
I've kind of learned that from doing this show, what you said about Voyager, people either loving it or hating it. Personally, I'm kind of middle with Voyager, because there's a lot of things that I really like in Voyager. I think that some of the best episodes of Star Trek overall have been Voyager episodes. But I also mm-hmm. think that some of the worst episodes have been Voyager episodes.
Oh, there's that Evolution one with, or De-Evolution one, whatever it was, with Janeway and
where
Paris.
They went to Warp 10, yeah. And they
yes.
Started, yeah. Yeah.
That was terrible.
I felt like Voyager had some missed opportunities with the whole Maquis stuff, you know, because they almost completely forgot about that after the first episode, and just acted like they were just a regular crew, and they go back and they would revisit it a little bit from time to time, but I think
every once in a while do a security drill or
have
7 of 9 malfunction.
Yeah, there could have been a big arc that could have ran through the whole series of how do these two crews come together and work together. And I thought that they should have clashed more often than they actually did. But
I feel like that was also, though, because it was more a transitionary period for Star Trek. Mm-hmm. Because that, I can't remember if that came out before or after Roddenberry passed away.
It was after. Yeah, it was well after that.
Yeah, that's right. It was he passed away for DS9, during DS9.
Yeah.
So I feel like that was still them trying to figure out, how do we do Star Trek and have conflict, interpersonal conflict in it.
Yeah.
And so I feel like they were trying very much, hey, we're on a spaceship, and these people have to live with each other every day. We can't just write off this character who got into a fight with somebody else to a transfer to another ship.
Mm-hmm.
And so we have to figure out how to make this work. And they just kind of fell back into the habits of other Star Trek that they had been doing, the movies, the TV shows. So
I think that
it was just a tough writing thing that they had.
Have you ever seen the documentary that William Shatner did about the Next Generation and how it all came to fruition and stuff? I think it was called, I want to say it was called Captain on the Bridge or something like that.
Yes. Yeah, it was on Netflix. I don't know if it still is, but yeah, I remember watching that, and it was interesting to get everyone's take on that. But
yeah, they talked a little bit about what you were saying. Roddenberry did not want the crew to argue amongst themselves. He didn't want any conflict between the characters. He wanted all the conflict to come from outside. And the writers were, well, that kind of sticks us in a spot, because we can't really write the stories that we want to write, because we have to bring in exterior conflict all the time. We can't have anything going on between the characters, and it really, you know, tied their hands. And it wasn't until after Roddenberry he kind of stepped down before he passed, and it wasn't until then that they were able to really start doing some of the stuff that you really got to see in Deep Space Nine and Voyager between the characters. I don't think the Next Generation ever really got to deal with a lot of you know, relationship stuff. It's like that crew seemed to get together. I mean, get along all the time, the entire series.
Yeah, they were all best friends.
Yeah, basically.
So, I mean, although that made it easy for you to, as a audience member, to like everybody on that crew.
Yeah.
Because there was, some people may not have been as dynamic, but you liked everybody on the Bridge of the Next Generation. On DS9, there were some people that you may not have liked.
Mm-hmm.
And usually they made... The beauty of the old Star Trek, not the new stuff as much, but the old Star Trek is they gave everybody a time to shine and a time to become a person.
Right.
And so that you were like, oh, I actually like this person.
Right. Yeah. So, that's how I felt about Quark. You know, he's in the first season, he's like this despicable, slimy character. And by the end of the show, he's grown more than any of the other characters, really.
he's a Ferengi with a heart of gold.
Right. I mean, yeah.
he wants to be that. He wants to be the money grubbing, greedy Ferengi, but he just isn't.
Yeah.
He just can't do that. I don't know if that has. It'd be interesting to go through that and compare that to maybe toxic masculinity.
Yeah.
and how that is. Because Star Trek, I keep finding these parallels to things that just have not even happened yet. So, or that we haven't realized is a thing yet. But yeah, he definitely was trying to fit the mold of what his society was telling him, and he just grew beyond that.
Did you have any Star Trek toys or merchandise, collectibles, anything like that?
You know, we did not. We didn't get a lot of name brand toys. We would usually do like dollar store toys because as a kid, you don't know any better, and mom can buy you five toys for the price of one of the other.
Oh, so, yeah.
So I mean, the beauty about being a child though, and the way that Star Trek worked is you could pick up a stick, and just in your imagination, that could be a phaser.
Mm-hmm.
So we definitely played it, but I did not have any of the toys, and I've watched a few minutes of the documentary about the toys on Netflix.
The toys
right
that
now,
made us, yeah.
The toys that made us, and I'm just looking. I've watched some of it. And I'm just like, that just does not make any sense at all.
The Star Trek episode, is that the one that have you watched? Any
yes,
of that?
Okay, yeah. With the Spock with the weird helmet. Spock.
Yeah. There was a merchandise. I don't know. Roddenberry wasn't, I don't guess he was in charge of the merchandising or whatever, but it was pre-Star Wars. You know, Lucas kind of changed the way movies and their toys and merchandise and stuff, the way anybody did any of that stuff after that. But Star Trek was before that. So basically, they took toys that were already out there and just slapped Star Trek on the side of it and put it in the stores and people would buy it. So there wasn't like one set series of toys, like here's some Star Trek action figures. It's like there's just all this stuff that has nothing to do with Star Trek, and we're just gonna say put the logo on the side of it or something.
How much do you think it was the people who liked Star Trek buying it versus the parents and friends of the people who like Star Trek? Like, oh, Johnny loves Star Trek, I'm gonna get him this Star Trek helmet because I don't know what it is, but I'm sure he will.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there was a lot of that. And a lot of stuff, like, you know, when I was a kid, I would go into the store and I would see a lot of toys and stuff that just had pictures of my favorite cartoon or something on the side of it. And I would tell my mom, hey, I want this or whatever. But, you know, I kind of get where you're coming from. You know, my parents didn't have a lot of money growing up. So there was actually going to the toy store was a big deal. You know, it was something that I did after my birthday when I had gotten a lot of money from my grandma or something like that, you know. But when you go to Walmart or Kmart or something like that, and you just, mom, I want this. And she'd look at the price. And if it was, you know, a couple bucks, then maybe maybe you could.
Well,
look.
Your birthday's coming up in 11 and a half months.
Right.
Wait till then.
Okay. So what about books and comics and stuff like that? Did you ever get into that stuff?
You know, I did not read any of the books. I read a couple of the comics. I'm a huge comic fan. We are a fandom podcast. We talk a lot about comics.
Mm-hmm.
However, I have a hard time with anything that has been a TV show, like started as a TV show and then serialized into comics. But the latest stuff that I can't remember who has the rights right now. I think it's IDW.
Yeah, I
could be wrong. Right. They did this really cool crossover with the Kelvinverse and the Prime Universe. And I So recently I've read a couple of them, but when I was younger, I just had a hard time. I could not read a comic that was based off of a television show. Some of it may have been the art, because, you know, I know what these people are supposed to look like. It's not like a cartoon where, well, yeah, it changes from time to time. But I know what Captain Picard's supposed to look like. And so when I get art that's not exactly on par, it makes it hard for me to, or it takes me out of the story. So I haven't read a lot, but as I've gotten older, I can kind of separate the two a little bit. And it's just kind of, they have some cool what ifs. I've just never gotten into them too much in the comics and books.
I think that the thing with the comics, Star Trek comics, is that they've changed hands so many times. And every time they change hands, you get new artists and you get new writers. Mm-hmm. And so the quality of the stories change. You can't get like a story arc going if you're just going to swap over to a whole new company in 2 years or whatever. So I read a few of them when I was a kid, but it wasn't a comic that I needed to go and get the next issue every week. You know, it was just, oh, there's a Star Trek comic, and, you know, pick it up. But I read the one that you're talking about, the Kelvin Universe, because I had somebody on the show a couple months back tell me about it, and I went and looked it up on Comixology and downloaded it. It's the one where they go to like a Kelvin version of Deep Space Nine or something like that. Is it the one you're talking about?
I did not read that one.
Oh, okay.
But it very much makes sense that that's where they could have gone with it.
Yeah, so they did Q decided to go into the Kelvin universe, and when he got there, and he took Kirk into the future, and it was the Kelvin version of the Deep Space Nine era.
That would be really interesting to see how the Cardassians fared with the Federation being a lot more warlike.
And everything is totally different because history changed, you know, way back in the original series timeline. So everything from that point on changed. So when he got to the Deep Space Nine era, all the players were there. They were just in different parts. They were doing different things, you know. So it's pretty cool.
I think that part of the reason why I never got into the books as well is because I never really had to. I got into Star Trek in the early 90s, essentially. Mm-hmm. And from the Next Generation, I was then able to watch Deep Space Nine, and then I was able to watch Voyager. And then about the time Enterprise came out, I also started figuring out what girls were. And so I kind of left a lot of TV and movies and stuff behind at that point. But I never really had that hunger for it, I guess, because from my perspective, I just had it every day, every week. And if I played sick a lot, I could have the original series too.
Yeah. Yeah. When did you, so your series is The Next Generation. That's the one that you most align yourself with, right?
Yeah. I probably most align it with. The one that I remember the best is Voyager, but the one that I align with and like, I feel like taught me more morals and gave me a world perspective was probably The Next Generation for, you know, the last few years of its run.
So when did you find yourself going back and really checking out like the original series?
Obviously it was hard because you know, if we didn't have it in the house or anything like that.
It's just whenever it's on,
it was whenever it was on.
Right.
I probably want to say I watched a lot of the original series like when I would spend the night at grandma's house and she had cable and it was on some channel on syndication. But then once Netflix hit, I binged probably in 2005, I binged Star Trek pretty heavily from the original series up and through Voyager. So that was recent that I was able to watch every episode of the original series.
What about the movies? When did you watch the movies? Like the original series movies?
So the original series movies, I do remember watching them as a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I also remember not getting them very well because yeah. I was like, wait a minute, that's not a Klingon, because I had seen the Tribble episode.
Not
a Klingon. And then I was like, but that's cool. And then it was like, oh, but that's Star Trek The Next Generation. So it was that always the continuity kind of messed with my brain. But you know, the original series movies were not as integral to my fandom, because it really started in the Next Generation era. However, they were a huge part of my family, and we would quote them all the time. And I find that interesting that I don't have a huge connection, and yet we quote them all the time. Things like, well, I can't tell you how many times we've used nuclear vessels,
right?
Or my mom, she prides herself in being computer illiterate, although she's not as illiterate as she would make herself sound. She'll walk up to the computer and just be like, computer.
Hello, and, computer.
Yeah. And, well, now we've got echoes, and so it kind of works.
Right.
So.
Yeah, I think for me, I mean, my first memory of Star Trek is watching The Next Generation, but that took me back to, I was like you, you know, you only watch the original series when it's on. But I went to the video store and I picked up the movie, and it was after I started getting into The Next Generation, because I was like, well, I want to check out some of this other stuff, you know. So so I rented the motion picture to get home and watch it, and it bored the heck out of me. And
of pretty shots of the spaceship, though.
Yeah, that's true. But it was long, and I was probably 11, maybe 12, you know. And so that kind of turned me off of the movies for a while. I kept watching The Next Generation, and finally The Wrath of Khan came on TV one night, and it was like Sunday night at the movies or whatever, and mm-hmm. I started out kind of, it was on while I was doing something else, and then by the end of it, I was watching the movie, you know, and then Spock dies at the end, which that really didn't connect with me, because I didn't really watch the series until later on, so I didn't get the relationship between Kirk and Spock at that point. You know, to me it was just, there was this, one of these guys is dying, you know. And but then my dad is walking through the room as that scene's happening, and he says, "Ah, yeah, but he comes back to life in the next one." And I was like, "The next one?" You know, so
there's another one.
Right, yeah. So
well, I find that story though really, really interesting, about how, you know, the Nimoy was like, "I'll do this, but you have to kill me at the end."
Yeah,
and then it turned out to be such a success that he's like, okay, I guess you can bring me back, but I have to direct.
Right. Yeah, exactly. I listened to one of his autobiographies, which he wrote three or four of them, I think. But the one that was called I Am Spock, he kind of told that. He kind of told that story where he kind of wanted to come back for another one, but he didn't really know how they were going to do it until he was at the premiere and he saw the Genesis planet at the end. And he said that, you know, he turned to, I guess it was his wife that was with him, he turned to her and said, "I think Paramount's going to be giving me a call." So, all right, so The Next Generation goes off the air in 1987. Were you still big into the show at that point? Did it affect you that show was going off the air?
Well, so The Next Generation aired.
I'm sorry, it went off the air in 1994. I'm sorry.
I'm like, yeah. Wait a minute.
Yeah, so did it affect you that the show was going off the air? Did you care?
You know what? No, I was pretty happy with the way that it wrapped things up. I mean, the finale was just a big deal in my family. I mean, we don't have appointment viewing anymore, but that was definitely one. We never had a Super Bowl party in my house, but we had, and that was my dad taking pity on my mom, or vice versa, because my parents raised geeks, even though my dad loved the sports. And you can tell I'm a geek because I just referred to it as the sports.
Sports ball.
yep. But we made sure that we were there. I think those were some of the days where we actually were allowed to eat dinner in front of the television. And so, I mean, it was a big deal. And I love endings where the endings, where the endings you feel good about the way that things wrap up, and it kind of ties some bows on some storylines that had not had bows tied on them previously. And you know, and then they had the movies, and so I wasn't so concerned about that, because And I don't know how he knew it, but my dad said, oh, there's lots of movies that are going to come from this. Maybe it was because of Star Trek, the motion picture and stuff like that. But I just never expected that. And, you know, the final episode of The Next Generation was in 94, but DS9 was already airing in 93.
Right.
And then it wasn't much long after that that Voyager came out. So for a long while, we were getting two episodes a week.
Yeah. Yeah, Deep Space Nine kind of hit its stride about the time that the Next Generation left, too. So,
mm-hmm.
My dad had the night that the finale aired. My dad had a heart episode. He didn't have a heart attack, but he had a heart episode and had to go to the hospital. And so we all went to the hospital and. He was okay, you know. They got him in a room. They wanted to keep him there for a couple of days, and I was probably 14 at the time, I think, something like that. So they get him to his room, and he's awake and he's lucid. He's fine by that at that point. But we're all sitting in the hospital room. He looks at me and he says, "You know, you're missing Star Trek, right?" And I said, "Is it on?" And he was like, "Yeah," and he turned it on. So I ended up watching it on the hospital TV while everybody was was in visiting with my dad and stuff. So, but I thought that was cool. He comes to himself. He's fine and everything, and he's worried about me missing my show. So
I think that says a lot about parent, though. You know, I'm here in the hospital, but I know you love this thing, so pay attention to this thing.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. And also, you know, 14-year-olds hanging out in the hospital, extreme boredom, you know. Right.
No smartphones, no iPads.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah.
How did we survive?
Yeah, when your phone goes dead and you don't have a charger for a couple of hours, you find out real quick, how did I survive without this thing?
Oh, I bought an extra battery case to make sure that I always have a charge.
Right.
I mean, that's. I'm not willing to learn that lesson.
So, The Next Generation went off the air, but the movie came out a few months later. So, were you excited about the movie?
I was super excited about the movie. I remember going and seeing it in the theaters. I think I saw that one twice in the theaters. And up until that time, the only other movie that I'd been allowed to was that the first one? I'm trying to remember when the special edition movies came out for Star Wars.
Yeah, they didn't. They I think came that was after. Yeah, they didn't come out till 97. So
it so, was a couple years so then later. Star Trek was the first movie that I ever saw twice in a theater.
Okay.
Because, you know, my parents did a good job making us not feel like we were poor when we were kids, but we didn't have a lot of money for extras. And so for us to go to a movie twice, that said something about that. But I don't know. I think I feel as a child, I missed out on a lot of the messages. Since I've watched it again, as I've been a little bit older. But I remember loving the fact that, hey, this is just a little bit bigger. This is a little bit more. Why didn't they do this for every episode?
Yeah. And I was probably a little bit older than you when I saw it. So my main thought was, why is everything so dark? You know, it's like they turned half the lights off in the Enterprise all of a sudden. But but what about what did you think when you saw the ship crash or half the ship explode and the other half crash to the planet?
I don't think it affected me that much, but I'll tell you that's one of those formulaic things that it's in Star Trek now that I could give up. Like the ship doesn't have to crash every single time.
Yeah, yeah.
That's one of those things. It's we don't have to have the ship on a planet every single movie. I don't know. I am a bad. See, when it comes to lots of things, I am so bad at details. I remember sitting there watching the story. I remember things in the story. I don't think it made that big of an impression on me. But I saw it twice, and I wanted to see it twice, and I remember wanting to see it twice. But I couldn't tell you how I felt. Felt about stuff during the movie, with the exception of I saw it twice.
Yeah.
I mean the part with Kirk, I remember that part. The the wood chopping scene, I remember that was kind of weird inside the Nexus.
Yeah.
But I was young. I was young, and I didn't get most of the themes, I think.
Yeah, that was the only thing that I never really understood in that is they can leave the when they leave the Nexus, they can come out at any time that they want, right? So why not go back far enough that you can save the ship and everything? It's like you just gotta go back a few minutes. But that wouldn't work for the plot, I guess. But okay, so you said that you were big into Deep Space Nine. You watched it with your brother. What did you think when I think it was season 4 and Worf comes on the show and they ramped up the theme song got a little more bass to it and also that's when they really started the long story arcs where one story could go 3, 4, 5 episodes or whatever, and then they had arcs that went through all the way to the end of the series by that point. So what were your thoughts when they brought Worf on as a regular character?
Well, so I remember at first seeing it and having, I want to say it went to, it started out on a shot on his feet or something like that, and it would panned up and slowly the realization dawned, this is Worf. I do remember that, and that was one of the biggest inside baseball nerd things that I remember being excited about. Like, I know who that is because I watched the other show too.
Yeah.
And I mean, so I remember that being cool. I like the serial nature of the way television has gone nowadays. In some ways, I wish that we had stayed episodic for some reason, some things. Like, it's so hard to tell somebody how to jump into the middle of a show nowadays.
Yeah.
It's like, no, you just have to go back to season 1 and 2. They're okay. Stick with them. But by the time you get to season 3, it's going to be amazing. And it's hard to say, oh, just jump into season 3 because you have to know the things from seasons 1 and 2. But right. I really like that as if I can get into a show from the beginning, I really enjoy the fact that there are threads that pay off later on and longer arcs. The Dominion War is probably one of my favorite story arcs in all of Star Trek. Just watching how that goes, watching the morality show up in the Pale Moonlight is probably one of my favorite episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just because it was just so deep and it was so unlike anything Star Trek that I had ever seen before. And I mean, with that, we were able to see we were able to get a lot more depth into the characters, I feel, because a story didn't have to reset the universe at the end of the episode.
Right.
It could be, things could actually have consequences, and see how people behave when their actions have consequences. You get to feel a little bit more connected to. And to be honest, I'm going to sound a little bit like a hypocrite but contradictory, because that's one of the biggest things that I dislike about Discovery. Like if you compare DS9 to Discovery, there you can very clearly see the logical storytelling path that they took. But I don't like Discovery as much because you don't get as much into the other characters. Like, you probably can't even name, well, you might be able to because you host a show about it, but naming the bridge characters on the Discovery, there's not a lot. I mean, you've got Saru, you've got Michael, you got the android-ish lady, and you've got the person with the weird haircut.
Right.
I mean, it's hard to know more of the characters that way. I wish that. So I really liked that about DS9. You got to know. I feel like Sisko is one of the captains that we get to know his inner workings the best. And his thought process the best.
Right.
Because Picard, you never had to know his thought processes because his thought process was, I'm right. Here's the solution.
Yeah.
Janeway, she wouldn't let anybody see her inner processes because her role was, I have to be the rock. I have to be the anchor of this ship that everybody can lean on for support.
Right.
And so she could never be flustered. But Sisko, you got to see him have aha moments, and you got to see him have moments that he regretted, and I don't know. Maybe it was. He's a lot more expressive, and so the way that they were able to do that with him, and then the whole arc with Worf and Dax, you know, starting out with Jadzia and then going to Ezri, I thought you got to see a lot of great relationship, and what does this mean? Because you throw in a character like you throw in a character like a Trill and a symbiote Trill, and there are obvious benefits. You got multiple lives there.
Right.
And they kind of played a little bit with the, oh, here's a former host's spouse that's coming to the ship or something like, oh, we knew each other when you were a former host. But you never got to see somebody that you like, oh, this, I'm invested in Worf and Dax, and then Dax becomes this new Dax.
Right.
And then all of a sudden it hits home a little bit more. So I don't know. I thought it was interesting, the things that they got to play with, the morality of war, the alliances, and you know, this, I'm trying to think about this. This came out shortly after the first Gulf War, right? So
Deep Space Nine started in 92, I think. It started in the Next Generation's sixth season. So that would have been 92, 93. So it was after the Gulf War, because the Gulf War was, what, 90, 91, something like that?
Right, right. Yeah. 90, 91. And then, so I'm just, because it was in between those two Gulf Wars, and I wonder what prompted them to go the war route, because, boy, we've, as a nation, as a world, we have really had to think a lot about the morality of war.
Yeah.
And Star Trek was the forefront there. Like, hey, we helped you think about this before. Maybe go back and watch some episodes.
Yeah, yeah. And Deep Space Nine, they really got to play with a lot of stuff. That, and they took a lot of risks, especially like with the non-episodic nature of the show. Because now that's the norm, but it's really easy to go back and start a show from the beginning if you want, because most of them are on Netflix or they're on Hulu or something like that.
Right.
Whereas Deep Space Nine, you just had what was on. You know, you couldn't go back and watch the pilot. I mean, I think they released them on video, but they didn't release like every single episode in sequence. They would just release like,
well, this was a popular episode.
Yeah, the greatest episodes, like this videotape would have 2-3 of the greatest episodes or something like that. So and DVD hadn't even become a thing yet, where they would start releasing entire seasons on DVD and stuff like that. So yeah, they did take a lot of risks, and some of that stuff carried on into later series, and some of it didn't. Like you said with Discovery, the one thing that I do like about Discovery is that you've got this core set of characters that we follow week to week, but it's not entirely the senior staff. You know, all the other Star Trek series, we only focus on the senior staff, you know, and then on Discovery, it's not entirely that way, you know. One of the main characters on the first season was a doctor who is not the main doctor. He's just a doctor on the ship, you know.
Right, so, right.
So I do like that aspect of Discovery, but
I remembered when they announced Discovery, I was concerned because they said the main character would not be the captain. And I was like, of course the main character's not the captain, because there is no main character on Star Trek. Although there is very much a main character now.
Yeah.
So it's, but you're right. They do a good job. I mean, they've got Tilly, who is not, she doesn't even have a rank. She's still a cadet, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so she's just, I mean, they focus on people who are not all the key decision makers. But at the same time, I'm thinking about like a Navy vessel, and you're not going to have, I mean, Tilly played some integral roles in the first season of Discovery, and you're not going to have some cadet doing all of those things. When the chips are down, you get the senior staff to get in there and be in charge.
Yeah. Well, on the Next Generation, they let Wesley do a little more than he probably should have been allowed to do, but that was more of a product of who he was related to more than anything else. But so
it's not what you know, it's who you know.
Exactly.
And then what you know.
So the Next Generation movies of, you know, we talked about Generations, but then they got into like First Contact and Nemesis. I'm not Nemesis, but Insurrection and stuff like that. So what did you think of those three movies in that series after Generations?
I loved First Contact. I thought it was, you know, it was a great movie. It was more than just like a big 2 hour long episode. I felt like it was a great movie. It was a great story. I mean, Star Trek and time travel, even though Star Trek is a space show and not a time travel show, Star Trek and time travel just go together so well.
Yeah.
Like some of the best Star Trek episodes ever involved time travel. And so First Contact was great for that. Let's see. The Insurrection was the Borg Queen. No, that was First Contact.
Yeah.
That was First Contact.
Insurrection was the Fountain with of Data. Youth. Yeah.
The Fountain of Youth, the one in the... Yeah, the villains in that one were weird.
Mm-hmm.
The whole romantic subplot... You know, but I feel like they shoved the romantic subplot in every single one of the movies. And I don't know if it's because they're like, okay, we got to find a way for the nerds to be able to tell their wives, let's go to a movie.
Yeah.
But, I mean, the even in First Contact, the weakest part I feel of First Contact was the romantic subplot between Picard and that one girl. And was it...
it wasn't really a romance. I mean, it can come off that way, but they seem to me to be developing more of a close friendship than an actual romance. There was never a kiss or anything like
that's
that.
That's true. You know, that's true. So,
and she was a lot, which you can't say she was a lot younger than him because most of the women that they put Picard with are a lot younger than him. But, but I felt that's probably why they had the romantic subplot in Insurrection, because they didn't really do one in First Contact. And I heard a rumor, a guy at the convention that I went to a couple weeks ago, he told me that the reason that Alfred Woodard's character was even in First Contact was because when they originally wrote the script, whoever wrote the script wanted to write Zefram Cochrane as a woman. They wanted to, and then, you know, somebody came out and said, well, you can't make him a woman because he's a man. And they said, well, there's nothing in canon that ever actually said that he was a man. And I was like, yes, there is. He was in an episode. You know, and they go back and show him the episode, and they're like, oh, crap, well, we've already written this whole script and everything. So they took a lot of the female characteristics that they had given to Cochrane in that script and created another character to do that stuff, and then had Cromwell come in as the actual Cochrane or whatever. I don't know if that's true. That's just what somebody told me, and it kind of makes sense that they would.
It makes a lot of sense the way that fits together. I wonder. As you were explaining that, you know, one of the hardest things about Star Trek is getting everything to match up inside a canon, because right. I mean, it's only as good as the best memory on your group, and with the internet, that's gotten a lot easier. But you know, continuity and retcons are a thing. Would it be as good if we had a James Bond style universe that could reset? And I mean, we have had resets, but the only way that the fans even were able to keep their heads from exploding was by saying, "Oh, this is a different timeline."
Right. Yeah.
So I wonder if it would be better if we just had the James Bond style timeline where it's like, no, these are just movies. Don't try to connect to them. Yes, it's the same character, but do not try to connect these.
Yeah, I was having a conversation with some... It wasn't on the show. I think it was at that convention I was just talking about. I was having a conversation with someone about just that thing. And my theory is that... And I know fans are never going to do this. Fans need to let go of a little bit of the canon gatekeeping. Because Discovery did some things that a lot of fans are saying, well, that doesn't go along with canon. And that's true. But when you've got a series like this that's been on for 50 plus years, you have to be able to tweak the canon a little bit every now and then, or else you're going to limit the way you can tell your stories. Because you can't keep telling the same story over and over, and people are going to mess up and miss something that was in canon from 40 something years ago, and then fans attack that. And it's like, just watch the show. It's, you know, it doesn't matter that much. You know, just, yeah, I mean, they don't need to come out and say, well, Spock was a woman the whole time or something crazy like that. But, you know, tweaking things here and there, like the way the Klingons look and you know, the Enterprise had its nacelles in this direction instead of the other direction, you know, things like that. You have to be able to tweak that kind of stuff over the course of time, because like I said, you know, 50 something years is a long time to try and adhere to a Bible of rules, you know.
Well, and storytelling changes. I mean, the core concept of storytelling stays the same, but certain elements in the way we tell stories changes over time. Somebody was telling me, and it may have been on one of your shows, because I get a lot of Star Trek news from your shows, but who was it that was saying that the reason that the Romulans weren't in the original series was because the makeup cost too much?
I think that was on the bonus episode that I released a couple weeks ago from the convention.
Okay.
That I was at. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, I mean, because you have budgets, you have to work around certain things. And so, yeah, I feel like one of the best changes that Discovery did was the Klingons. I mean, they're hard to understand. They've got a lot of prosthetics in their mouths.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the way that they made several subtle changes made it a lot more dynamic. Then all of a sudden you can start spinning all sorts of headcanon about different classes and different, you know, different races. Because, I mean, you look at humans and we look pretty similar in a lot of ways. But in a lot of ways, a lot of us look different from each other.
Yeah.
And so then all of a sudden you can start thinking about, you know, racial. How would a Klingon handle civil rights? And I mean, the short answer is probably they wouldn't. But you know, they reached warp speed somehow, so maybe they would.
Yeah.
And so I really liked how you had the albino. I really liked how Volk looked different than the other Klingons. I mean, it made it more dynamic, and it's simply because it was cheaper to do those prosthetics now than it would have been to do them in the 90s.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, and that's one thing that's always gotten on my nerves with Star Trek is that they'll have an entire planet of people, and they all dress the same, and they all have the same haircut. You know, I'm glad we're moving away from some of that now, because it just doesn't make sense to have that big of a class of people, and you know, and they're all the same. Kind of like the same way that George Lucas created entire planets that only have one climate. You know,
yeah, one climate, the desert planet of Tatooine.
The ice planet, not, yeah, all that kind of stuff. Okay, so what about Nemesis? Did you what'd you think of that?
Oh, that one was interesting. I mean, from here on out, the movies have mixed results. I don't know, it felt very
not Star Trek.
Star Trek adjacent.
Yeah,
like there was a lot of good sci-fi in it, but not quite Star Trek. I mean, it was actually Tom Hardy's first real speaking role.
Yeah,
and I mean, Rick Berman was kind of taking credit for making Tom Hardy a star by saying, "Hey, we took a chance on him and gave him a big role." Just recently, him and The Rock got their acting starts on Star Trek.
Right.
But I don't know. It just there were a lot of things that didn't feel Star Trek. However, you compare Nemesis to Star Trek Into Darkness. Oh, it felt much more Star Trek.
Yeah.
So I guess it all depends on what measure you're measuring it against.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like I said, that was the era where things started to. I stopped watching as many sci-fi shows for a few years before I realized, oh no, this is dumb to focus on things that other people like. I'm going to focus on the things that I like.
Yeah, the one thing about the movies is that a lot of Star Trek episodes don't really have a villain. You know, they have a situation that they have to get out of or something like that. But when you make a movie, then they have to come up with a villain every time. And I just don't think Star Trek always plays well in that sandbox. You know, that seems like a whole different thing. I think Star Trek works better on episodic television than it does in the theater. You know, I still love the movies. I still go to the movies. They're always going to get my money, you know. But but I think that Star Trek on television just works better than it does in the movies. But
think about Star Trek, and you think about the moralities that it teaches. And, you know, most of the time there's not a villain in the world. We like to villainize people and things and objects and, you know, whatever. But most of the time it's what are you going to do in this scenario? And I feel like that's a reason why a lot of people watch Star Trek, is because they want to see how a perfect version of our society basically would react to situations. I saw a really funny meme about the Space Force. You know, what we want it to be is Star Trek. What we fear it will be is the First Order from Star Wars.
Yeah.
And what it will probably be is, I can't remember exactly which one they used, but it was essentially, it was Spaceballs. So, I mean,
right.
There's that thing. We want our future to be like Star Trek. And a lot of that entails, how are we going to react to certain situations?
Yeah. And another thing that Nemesis, got hurt from was the fact that they wanted to make a Star Trek movie that wasn't as Star Trek as the others. I mean, they basically said that they hired a director that really, not only had he not directed any Star Trek before, he didn't even watch Star Trek. He wasn't a Star Trek fan. Can't remember his name off the top of my head right now.
Stuart Baird.
Okay, there you go. I think at that time, the only big thing that he had directed a film with Jodie Foster where she was on an airplane and she was being chased by somebody through this airplane or something like that. So when the bridge was compromised and things started getting sucked out into space, you know, he could do those kinds of scenes really well because he had done like an airplane movie that where he basically did the same thing, you know. But as far as knowing your Star Trek characters and the relationships and how A goes to B goes to C, he didn't know, you know. So, and it showed. Yeah,
I mean, through all time, I'm just looking at his IMDb now. He did Executive Decision, U.S. Marshals, and Star Trek Nemesis. Though that was all he did. He's been an editor on a lot of movies, but I find it interesting that the studios don't really learn their lesson. I mean, I know you're trying to kind of grow chronologically here. But I see a big parallel to J.J. Abrams, because when they asked J.J. Abrams to direct the new Star Wars or Star Trek, when they asked him to direct the new Star Trek, he said, I was more of a Star Wars fan than a Star Trek fan growing up. I don't really know it. And so the only way that I will do this is if we can throw this out, if we can throw all of the backstory out and I can do it how I want to do it.
Yeah.
And I mean, and that explains the Kelvin universe right there.
Right. Yeah. And at least they said in the film that it was a new universe, because I was going into that movie not expecting great things. The first 09 Star Trek, because don't mess with my Star Trek, you know. Don't destroy my timeline. When they came in and they said, oh, this is an alternate timeline, they actually said that in the movie, I breathed a little easier. Because, okay, so my timeline is still there. Maybe, possibly one day they'll go back to that, you know. So maybe I can enjoy this a little more now. And I did enjoy the first, the 09 Star Trek, you know. I saw parallels of that movie and in Star Wars. It kind of, if you really look at the plots, they kind of parallel. There's a lot of similarities between those two. So you can tell that he's more of a Star Wars guy than a Star Trek guy. But overall, I thought that the characters, you know, the people that they got to play the characters, I thought that they got those characters spot on.
Oh, yeah. The characters are great. And, you know, I 9 times out of 10, when you recast a character in a remake, I am not going to hold them to the character that they're recasting. You know, I mean, if it's from one season to the next, I might be like, well, you're not the same character. But for a remake, if you want to go a slightly different direction, that's fine. the, you know, the Uhura and Spock relationship, I was okay with that because, you know what, we've explored this avenue. Let's explore a different avenue. But, you know, the Carl Urban is, I think, universally one of the guys who is noted as he is Bones. Like I don't know exactly what it is about him, but he's got those mannerisms and that swagger down because he and my brain just went blank. But the original Bones, they look nothing alike.
Oh yeah,
DeForest Kelly. Thank you. They look nothing alike. DeForest Kelly looks like a nerdy doctor.
Right.
Carl Urban doesn't. So I mean, I loved the casting there, and you know what? To be honest, I was glad that they brought it back. They could have given me anything and I would have been happy with it because they brought Star Trek back. Mm-hmm. They brought it back into public consciousness. And you know what, if they have to change some of it to make it work today, that's fine. I'm also, you know, I mentioned with my, with my siblings, I would watch Doctor Who, the classic Doctor Who on PBS on Saturday nights.
Mm-hmm.
And I was a Doctor Who fan back in the Tom Baker era.
Yeah.
And there was like three of us in my school who knew what that was. And then they brought back Doctor Who, and, you know, Christopher Eccleston and then David Tennant and Matt Smith. And it's so much bigger than it ever was when I was younger. And with being bigger comes being different.
Right.
And there's a lot of people who are upset about that. But to me, I'm just happy because that means that I get more of what I love. It's there are some things that they changed that I loved, but also I've changed a little bit from the time that I was a kid. And if these stories hadn't changed at all and I grew, I'd be concerned that I was going to grow past them. So yeah. I'm glad that they're changing things. I have to take a deep breath and remind myself of that every once in a while. But I'm glad that things are changing because you're not going to hit a home run unless you swing the bat.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So you said that you didn't really care for Into Darkness.
Yeah, it just felt the least Star Trek in terms of, you know, moral situation, the random scene where the girl's changing behind Kurt.
Yeah.
I mean, there were a lot of logical fallacies there that I was just like, wait, well, you know, how it should have, I haven't looked to see if it exists, but how it should have ended the movie trailer thing, they could have had a heyday with that. There were so many things that they could have just stopped the problem in its tracks. And then the fact that the promotional and marketing material lied and everyone's like, oh, this is Khan, isn't it? And it's no Khan here. And then it's, oh, okay, it's Khan.
You can't believe anything that J.J. Abrams says. You never believe him. Yeah.
Ever. But yeah, the whole Khan thing, the whole oh, he's got magic blood and tribbles can save the world thing. That just, I don't know. And then there just wasn't as much emotional impact to it as I think they thought there was going to be. Because when everyone said, oh, is this Khan? And everyone was guessing it was Khan, and they said, no, it's not Khan. And then it ended up being Khan. People weren't shocked. There wasn't some big reveal. People were mad that they had been lied to.
Right.
And so I think their brains weren't in the space that they wanted it to be.
Yeah. So. Yeah. And there was in my opinion, there was really no reason for him to be Khan. You know, everything that he did in that movie could have been done if he had just been some random villain. You know.
Mm-hmm.
And the Tribble thing has always gotten on my nerves because, like it or not, these three movies, there are Star Trek fans out there that these three movies and Discovery are all they've seen. You know, they haven't gone back and watched the first of five series. So, if you watch Into Darkness, you don't know what a Tribble is. And yet they're making it integral to the plot. You know, they never explained what a Tribble was. They just said, oh, I'm just doing some tests on this Tribble's blood. And I'm like, well, what's a Tribble? You got to explain that.
Yeah, yeah. They can't have it both ways. They can't change everything and then hold true also to what was there. Because, you know, maybe in this timeline, Tribbles are big monstrous creatures or, you know. I guess the case could be argued that they were big monstrous creatures back in the Prime universe too. But
We played a game at a convention one year. is Sci-Fighters that we play on the show sometimes, on Cosmic Potato sometimes. Joe Crow does that at conventions, and with the audience, you know, and they pick who is going to battle, and then they pick who wins each battle. And one year he did Star Trek versus Star Wars, and if I'm not mistaken, I believe the Tribbles ended up winning the whole thing. because if you take a Tribble and drop it on a planet, eventually that Tribble will consume the entire planet.
So, a big fluffy locust.
Right, yeah. So Star Trek Beyond, you liked it a little better.
Yeah. I think that has to do with the fact that Simon Pegg was one of the writers on it, and that he got to that a Star Trek fan got to tell a Star Trek story.
Yeah.
And I think that's what it all boiled down to. And, you know, it was one of those things where, yes, it had a villain, but that villain was not necessarily the main villain throughout the entire.
Yeah.
Throughout the entire movie. Like, that, a lot of that story would have happened without Idris Elba's character.
Right.
It just could have. I mean, now granted, obvious big plot points that you had to have him, but there was a lot of, what do I do in this scenario? I've been captured by aliens. What do I do? I am on a ship that I need to get working again. How do I make this happen? I need to choose whether or not to trust this random person that I've just met. How does this happen? And then it's not really a bromance. It's almost the opposite of a bromance between Spock and Bones. I mean, it was just that it had the right amount of humor in it too, because it was Simon Pegg.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I think the fact that they found a story that resonated in the Star Trek universe made a difference.
I need to back up a little bit because we kind of skipped over Enterprise a little bit. I wanted to ask you what you thought of Enterprise when it originally aired.
Do you remember? I can't remember. Was that was that UPN still, or was it WB, or was it CW?
Yeah, it was on UPN. Yeah, it started the year the fall after Voyager went off. That was their next big show.
Okay, so Enterprise, I liked a lot of it. I can see why talking about finding stories that resonated in the Star Trek universe brought this up. I liked a lot of it. A lot of it, the stories resonated, but it's kind of had the Spider-Man 3 syndrome where the studio said, hey, Spider-Man 3, it was the focus groups. They love Venom. Let's throw another villain in there. Let's add this. Let's change this. A sexy Vulcan is just a little too much for me at some point. Now, granted, when it came out, when I was a teenager,
yeah,
I can't say I disagreed with it too much, but it wasn't Star Trek. I'm like, wait, what is this? This is like no Star Trek that I have ever seen before.
Yeah.
And I mean, maybe that's what they were going for. Maybe that's not. But the first episode where they're in the decontamination.
Yeah.
And I was like, well, I guess this is telling me how this is going to go.
that was so weird. I mean, that's like the least Star Trek thing, because I went back and started watching Enterprise again recently. Over the last few years, I've been trying to go back and watch all the series, and I finally got up to Enterprise a couple of months back, and I watched that episode, and they start rubbing that goo on each other and stuff. I'm like, this just that doesn't even feel like Star Trek. They don't do stuff like this.
I did like one of my favorite things about Enterprise, though, was the seeing things like Red Alert be invented. I was like, oh, that's cool. I could completely see how they were like, oh, we're out here. I guess we need to have something like this.
Yeah.
And oh, here's a scenario. Yeah, I mean, we humans, we learn from mistakes. And so, I mean, some of those scenarios probably should have been figured out before then, but I really liked watching it. It's kind of like watching Batman Begins and seeing, oh, there's a reason for this. Oh, that's why they do that.
Right.
Oh, this is how they figured out this aspect of it. And so there were some golden nuggets. There were some pieces where, you know, almost any storytelling is hampered when too many hands get into the storytelling process. If you hire somebody to tell a story, let them tell the story. Don't say, oh, but it has to have this and it has to have that and have this and that be really weird things like a shower decontamination scene. I enjoyed the fact that the universal translator was basically a human. I thought that was really cool. It was really cool to see the Enterprise origins essentially, but I almost feel like that would have been a better title for it than just Enterprise.
Yeah, because it's kind of telling that they leave Star Trek out of the title, especially right? for the first, I guess it was the first three seasons, it was just called Enterprise, and they finally put Star Trek in the title before they ended up canceling it. I also never really understood why the ship had to be called Enterprise, because there, you know, the episode of the Next Generation when Scotty comes back. And he goes to the holodeck and he says, show me the Enterprise. And the computer says, there have been 5 starships by that
no
name.
No bloody A, B, C, or D.
Yeah. And yeah. Like, you're forgetting about the about the one from Enterprise, apparently. Well, here's a question that I ask everybody. As a Star Trek fan, we are constantly exposed to little tidbits of philosophy, life lessons, and things like that. So what did Star Trek do for you that you feel made your life better?
I think growing up in a place that didn't have a lot of diversity, it was really nice to see diversity and see the fact that that diversity made the Federation stronger. I think that was a big thing that shaped who I am and how I took on the world, so to say. Not only did I see that, you know, people, whether they're blonde hair, blue eyed, or green skinned and horns coming out of their back, people are people. Right. And so that shaped a lot of who I was. And then it also helped me to try to view things from the other perspective. Because a lot of Star Trek episodes were about perspective. And seeing things the way that other people see them is key to getting along, key to civilization, key to working with people. And I feel like Star Trek taught me how to do that.
Okay. All right, well, you want to tell everybody where they can find your podcast and where they can find you online and everything?
So all of my podcast links are over at fandompodcast.com. If you don't want to go to the website, anywhere that they've got podcasts, we're there. Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Spotify, Google Play, all those fun places. So fandompodcast.com, though, is the home for everything that I do.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for being here.
Thanks for having me.